of the people who are against Christian military service, those three objections seem to be what it clusters around: the religious nature, the oath of loyalty, and the violence that's inherent in army life.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Andrew Garnett. He's the pastor of Hampton Baptist Church in Hampton Roads, Virginia, and author of the book, Christians and the Roman Army, Lessons for Today. I was glad to be able to have this conversation, and I think you'll find it to be informative and interesting as we deal with both some historical issues and some contemporary ones. Now, before we jump into that, I want to remind you that if you haven't done so yet, you really should subscribe to Word and Way's award-winning email newsletter, A Public Witness, where we deal with issues at the intersection of faith, culture, and politics, like issues of war and peace. Learn more, start reading, and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. And now here's my conversation with Andrew Garnett on Christians and the Roman Army. Well, Andrew, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to talk with you about your new book, Christians and the Roman Army, Lessons for Today. Before we start recording, you made a joke about how this wasn't exciting, but I actually think it is an interesting conversation. So, you know, you decided to spend some time thinking about this topic, researching it, writing it. So why? What captured your attention? Why did you decide that you wanted to spend some time on this topic?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think it's sort of a twofold explanation. It originally came out of my doctor of ministry work. Needed a practical project to connect the theory of the academy with a local church. So in my context, we have quite a few military bases in my area. I'm a pastor in Hampton, Virginia. I have the largest concentration of military bases of any area in the world. And we have some veterans in my congregation, but very, very few active duty people. And that, to me, seems like a population of people that we are, you know, not touching. And I kind of wondered why. And as I thought about it, it seemed to me that there is a little bit of a split where churches like mine, we would be on the more moderate to progressive end of Baptist life. Churches like mine may be a little bit wary about military outreach, whereas a more conservative, more evangelical church, if they're not reaching out to the military already, they have no, you know, ideological objection to. So I just thought about, why is this? Why are we not touching this population of people? What can we do to try to bridge some of those gaps? And so the project really emerged out of that. Could we look at the ways churches have dealt with this in the past and learn something from the history that might make a difference today? So that's how I got started. I guess the reason it turned into a book is the more I looked at it, the more I felt like it was really interesting and had something to offer to us today. So when I learned about a lot of topics in church history, conflicts in church history, they, to me, almost felt kind of hopelessly esoteric, I think. You know, does the Holy Spirit proceed just from the Father or from the Father and the Son? And even for me, somebody who's very interested in church history, I kind of struggle to see what difference does that make. But, you know, this is a topic where the question is much, the conflict is much more immediate and practical. We have this guy, he's in the army, can he join our church or not? That's, to me, very relatable, very practical, very pastoral, something we can easily relate to. And so I really think this, even though it's very far removed from our times, it does have something, I think, to say to us and teach us in the polarized times that we find ourselves in, where we have a lot of conflict.
Yeah, and you're already getting to what my next question was going to be, because your title is about Christians in the Roman army, so you're helping us think about the past, and then your subtitle, this idea of lessons for today. And so before we dig into some of the lessons and some of the things that you unpack, you know, why does it matter for us today to think about how Christians were thinking about the Roman army, you know, 2,000 years ago?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, so I would say on one level, you know, it may not matter all that much. I think I say that in the introduction at one point, that if you are looking for an obscure topic, how early Christians thousands of years ago related to this military force that doesn't even exist anymore, you know, that may not matter all that much. So it's, to me, it's very historically interesting. For people who have an interest in church history, might be interesting. If you have a military background, might be interesting. But, you know, on one level, it is not really the most pressing question of your life when you're thinking about how are you going to pay the bills and are my kids going to be safe in school? You know, this is small potatoes. But, you know, on a deeper level, I really think it is an interesting example of the way that the church has struggled with diversity and wrestled with difficult questions. And that is something that I think is very immediate. If you're in a church today, you have almost surely experienced some conflict at some point in your life, likely over some kind of big cultural question or big cultural touchstone. And this is an example of that. And to me, it's almost more helpful to look at it this way, because it's kind of lets us practice a little bit of conflict and thinking about conflict in a really safe way. Because if we think about, you know, the military today, for example, if you're a more progressive person, you might have one perspective on the American military, say. If you're a more conservative person, you have a different perspective on the military. And so we come into that conversation already with opinions and perspectives and maybe a little bit entrenched already. Whereas with the Roman army, like, that, you know, it does not matter to us. The early church's fight here is not our fight. So we can maybe look at it a little bit more objectively, have conversations, especially if we think about this topic with people who are different from us. Maybe we can have a conversation about this topic that is fruitful because we are not so entrenched in our views. So it, I really do think, has more to teach us and maybe a little bit more relevant than it seems at first glance.
So let's talk a little bit. I mean, you unpack this over multiple chapters, and obviously we don't have time to go through everything you do, so people are going to have to buy the book. You give us a couple chapters thinking about both the Roman Empire as well as the Roman army. And so I wonder if you can maybe share a couple of things that you found particularly interesting about life under the Roman Empire, particularly when it comes to this question of the role of the military in the Roman Empire.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would have kind of gone into this project, I think, and gone into this research thinking that, you know, the United States has a very strong military. We would be the, you know, in my opinion, probably the sole global superpower right now. Maybe there are some other up and coming countries, but if you think about premier militaries, the United States military would be one of them. And we spend a lot, from my perspective, on our military. But when you compare what we spend on our military compared to what the Roman Empire spent on the military, it's just, we're a drop in the bucket. So the Roman Empire was essentially a military state, and they were spending 70, perhaps 80% of all tax revenue was going to the army. Whereas we do spend some money on the army, but, you know, the bulk of the American government spending is things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, you know, programs designed to hopefully help citizens, help people. There was a tiny little bit of that in the Roman Empire, very limited, but pretty much the government took your taxes and spent it on the military. So I think we maybe kind of hard to, for us to conceptualize what a militaristic society it was. And if you as a citizen out, or citizen or non-citizen, you know, out in a province somewhere, if you met a government figure in your life, it was almost certainly going to be a soldier. And it would be the most common representatives that you would meet. So lots of contact with the military and with the army. Another way that's, you know, different from our society, I think, unless you live very near a military base, you probably don't have a lot of day-to-day interaction with a member of the armed forces, whereas they would have had much more, probably. And I think it's also an interesting kind of comparison, I suppose, us to them, and that if an ancient Christian wanted to talk about kind of big social issues of the time, talking about the army probably would have been one of the most important things you could talk about. It's where all your tax money is going, is to the army. It's going to be one of the chief cultural issues of the day. So them talking about the army, talking about Christian military service, is sort of like us talking about reparations for slavery or some other kind of big cultural thing that we're wrestling with. When we talk about that in our churches or talk about that from a faith perspective, we really are sort of following in the footsteps of these early Christians who are wrestling with that big cultural question too.
So let's talk about religion in the Roman army, because I found that to be, you know, particularly interesting in thinking about, again, you're talking about this all-encompassing, you know, military state. And then if you are in the army, you write at one point that you talk about modern military forces are largely secular. The Roman army, by contrast, was fundamentally religious in nature because the empire conceptualized warfare as a religious affair. Tell us a little bit about what's happening with religion inside the Roman military.
Yeah. So religion in the Roman army was sort of a microcosm of religion in larger society. many of us who live in the Western world would have some idea about separation of church and state. But in the ancient world, that generally was not the case wherever you were. You know, if you are come from a Christian background, familiar with the New Testament, you can think about how at the trial of Jesus or in struggles with Paul, you know, the religious authorities are the governing authorities. There's not really a distinction between the two. And that was pretty much true of all cultures in the ancient world. So there was not a secular government. Religion was just a part of everything. And so that extended to the army too. So there were some religious practices that were sort of mandated for the army. If you were a soldier, you would see certain festivals for the, say, for the military standards. These they weren't flags, but functioned like flags. You know, so there were ceremonies in honor of these standards that were, because the standards were almost divine things in themselves, and all the soldiers, you know, would see this, watch this. There'd be sacrifices before battles, before a camp was built. You know, just so many different religious elements that were mandated that the army observe. You know, honoring the emperor, imperial birthdays, you'd see sacrifices and things for that. So lots of mandated religious practices, but then the army also would have been kind of a melting pot of different religious practices, drawing people from, theoretically it was supposed to be citizens, were supposed to be in the army proper, the legions itself, but then there were these auxiliary units that could draw from anybody, citizens, non-citizens, people outside the bounds of the empire. So probably within the army, the legions itself, but then within the auxiliary units, even more, just a huge melting pot of people bringing their own religious beliefs and religious practices into their units. So you would have seen a lot of what we would call just traditional paganism, classic paganism, that the army mandated. But as long as you did that, the army didn't care what you did in your free time. So you probably also would have seen, you know, religions from all around the Mediterranean world and beyond being practiced. So just tremendous diversity and tremendous religious character in the army.
So before we start thinking too much about how Christians are participating or not and how they're thinking about the Roman military, it is important, I think, for us to do what you do, and that is to deal with a significant figure. And I mean, everyone that has thought about Christian responses to church and state in the Roman Empire knows that we have to address Constantine. So, you know, what's happening here, just for those that aren't familiar, why does he represent such a significant moment?
Yeah. So Constantine started out in the army. He was a military person. Eventually he took, after a series of civil wars, he took over the Roman Empire and became the sole emperor of the Roman world. So before Constantine, the empire was pagan in nature. Some emperors were made a religious policy very central aspect of their reign. For other people, the religion was there, but not so important, but the empire was a pagan system. Whereas Constantine, his religious evolution is a little bit unclear, but he seems like he started out as sort of a cautious kind of monotheist. By the end of his life, he was a pretty committed Christian. So somewhere along the way, he gets on board the Judeo-Christian movement and identifies himself as a Christian. And that him coming to power as emperor really creates, in my opinion, I think the perspective of a lot of other people, a really significant fundamental shift in religious life. Because before Constantine, it probably took a good bit of courage to be a Christian. And then after Constantine, it's almost the opposite. It increasingly takes courage not to be a Christian. As we get Constantine as a Christian emperor and generally Christian emperors following him. So as Christianity was discouraged before Constantine, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly, but kind of discouraged after Constantine, it's really the opposite. And paganism is discouraged more and more and more until it eventually becomes illegal. And you are very strongly encouraged to convert to Christianity. So Constantine really does create a cultural shift in the empire and the daily life of people at that time.
Yeah, and I think that's so important to note, because then that what that means is we would expect Christian responses to the Roman Empire and the Roman military to be different on either side of him. So let's do a pre-Constantine. And there's a couple different ways, and you try to unpack this in because we have some writings of, you know, Christian early church theologians and religious leaders thinking about theology. And again, we're talking about, you know, with the generations immediately after Jesus is the time period that we're dealing with here.
So let's talk with that first, kind of the writing, the official kind of conversation. What's happening here? What are the concerns about the Roman military and Christians particularly serving?
Yeah. So there are, I think one thing it's important to note is that there really are a variety of responses to the army, and people do see this very differently. So there is one thing the book tries to do is sort of categorize it into, well, some people tried this thing, some people tried this thing. And in reality, the distinctions in the past, you know, were not that neat. It's just, you know, people coming up with ad hoc solutions, writing different things. In hindsight, we could sort of categorize them, but there is tremendous diversity, for one thing, in the responses. But another thing that seems to be the case too is that there may have been a difference of opinion between sort of lay people, or I don't want to say less educated people, but, you know, people who did not spend their job thinking and writing about theology all day, the way those people saw the army and whether a Christian could engage with the army versus what a priest, a deacon, a trained theologian, what they think. So there's a real difference of opinion. There's an interesting story in the book, actually, about a guy named Tertullian, who, very significant figure in the early church, writes a lot of material about the army or otherwise. Very prolific writer, but he has a long book about Christian military service that is started. He writes this book because there was a Christian who in the military who was asked to wear a laurel crown, like a laurel wreath on his head, which would have been part of military parades at the time. And, you know, maybe this guy had done that for a long time. We don't exactly know his situation, but this one time he decided he didn't want to do that. That was too much against his religious conscience. And so he was martyred for refusing to wear the laurel crown. And so some Christians, Tertullian says, are grumbling about this guy in the army. Like, why did he do this? Because this peace that we have had for so long is being threatened. They kind of viewed it as a don't ask, don't tell. We can be in the army. You know, it's a doubtful question whether this is against my faith, you know, unclear. And Tertullian is writing to say, actually, no, this is completely against your, this is wrong. You can't be in the army. And here's all these reasons why. So what we have surviving is Tertullian's response of, here's all the reasons you can't. But even in his response, we have this sort of hint that, well, there's this whole mass of people whose writing has not survived, but who thought military service could be reconciled with their faith. So that's kind of a long introduction, but generally the way that people were writing about the military, especially church leaders, they were kind of opposed to three things. One would be the religious character of the army. They thought that was incompatible for Christians. Another was the oath of loyalty to the emperor. That was something that they found very objectionable. Some of them did. That we have sworn an oath of allegiance to Jesus, and Jesus is our Lord. So we cannot have Caesar, we cannot have the emperor as Lord anymore. So the religious character, the oath of loyalty, and then the violence was something that really bothered a lot of Christians. There's an apologist named Athenagoras who writes about how Christians, he thinks Christians shouldn't even go watch gladiatorial games in the arenas of the empire, because even to look at somebody being killed, he says, and take enjoyment out of that is the same thing as killing them. So if we can't even go watch the gladiatorial games, how in the world could we possibly put people to death? So of the people who are against Christian military service, those three objections seem to be what it clusters around: the religious nature, the oath of loyalty, and the violence that's inherent in army life.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, you know, so two of those are telling us something in response to the nature of the Roman Empire and the Roman military itself. Right. So this pagan nature and, you know, the emperor cult, all that, that, you know, those kind of religion. And then that third response, this issue of violence is irregardless of the religious nature or the loyalty of all of that, that there's an inherent, not that it's, you know, unanimous, as you know, but that there are a number of significant early church theologians that are saying Christians should not participate in violence of any sort.
Right.
And, I mean, we still have a little bit of that kind of pacifist wing in some of the historic peace churches. But at least in the United States, that's a minority opinion. But it seems to have been a very strong position, especially among those whose writings have survived.
Yep, definitely. Absolutely. You know, I would have, if you had asked me about, was the early church pacifist before I began this project, you know, I would have said yes, because that's certainly the dominant voice that has survived are from those people who, church leaders, who are very against the idea of violence.
So, you noted early on in our conversation of just kind of thinking about like practical issues, like, you know, can someone who's in the military join your church? And, you know, these are things that, as you note in the book, they're actually wrestling with. You know, Tertullian and others are wrestling with some very practical issues of, you know, what can a soldier do in this response? And what can a, you know, if, so we've been asking some questions. We've been talking about, you know, can Christians serve in the military? But then, so what do we do with converts? What is this question of someone who is already in the military and is now converting? What are some of the conversations that are happening about what needs to happen in that case?
Yeah, that's a great question. So people entered the military in the ancient world through a variety of different ways. In my context, in the United States today, you know, the overwhelming majority of people, 99.9%, I'm sure, of people in the armed forces are there because they volunteer to be there. You know, we don't have a draft or anything like that right now. There would have been some of that in the ancient world. Certainly some people volunteered for the army, particularly probably poorer people, people without a lot of socioeconomic options. The army was not a great life, but it was a better life than probably people on the margins of society enjoyed. You had guaranteed paycheck, guaranteed housing, and had access to health care. If you could survive, you get a pretty good retirement bonus. So it was certainly an attractive lifestyle if you did not have many options. So perhaps there are some Christians who just join because they, you know, how am I going to support myself in life? I need an option. This is the option I've got. So there may be some people who enter that way, but then there may also be some people who are drafted, who are conscripted, some tribes who had treaties with the empire were forced to provide, you know, a certain quota of soldiers. So it could be some people are forced in that way. A variety of different ways that people might have found themselves in the military. And so there is certainly some awareness that people will find themselves in the army in different situations. And so they need to, there may be different responses for different people. So Tertullian is one who certainly imagines that there is, he is aware that people will come into the army in different ways. And Tertullian's perspective is that there comes a point in when you are mature enough in your faith, you become instructed enough in your faith, you'll have to face some kind of choice of either getting out of the army somehow, maybe it's being martyred for your faith when you just can't, you're ordered to do something that's against your conscience, but there will be some kind of tipping point where you will have to leave. But then there are other people who I think have a little more nuance to them. Clement of Alexandria has a passage I think is very, very interesting. And he certainly seems to imagine that Christians who are in the army will find themselves there because they have been converted while they are there. The way he phrases it, it does not seem like he imagines Christians joining the army voluntarily when they are Christians. But he is talking about how people can use their faith in different aspects of life. Farmers can farm and still listen to God. You know, people who are sailors, they can sail and listen to God. But when he gets to talking about soldiers, he says, has knowledge taken hold of you while you're engaged in military service? So, you know, were you in the military and then Christian knowledge comes to you? Has knowledge taken hold of you while you're engaged in military service? Listen to the commander who orders what is right, is the what he has counseled to them. And the commander in that context is not your earthly commander, it's God. You're going to listen to God who orders you to do what's right. So it's a very ambivalent, with his other examples, farmers, sailors, he says, you can sail, you can farm, those careers, be a Christian. That one is much more ambivalent of listen to your commander who's going to tell you what the right thing to do is, your heavenly commander. Is the right thing to do, get out of the army, be martyred? Is it to try to be the best soldier that you can be in keeping with your faith? So Clement seems to have a much more ambiguous response for what people will do when they come to faith in the army. So there are different perspectives on that question.
Yeah, which I mean, I think what we catch is, you know, even with those that have some theological disagreement with Christians serving in the military are still also trying to figure out how to respond pastorally.
Yes, yeah, certainly. And there's a whole genre of literature that we hardly ever read anymore called church orders, which are basically church handbooks that people tried to create to do exactly what you're saying, answer pastoral questions. If a Christian has stolen something, you know, what is the response? Are they still church members? Do they have to have a certain period of repentance, you know, to give some very specific practical guidance, which, you know, in some ways you look back and think, well, this is really kind of problematic. It seems legalistic, you know, this one size fits all solution. I wouldn't necessarily endorse us going back to that kind of mindset today, but it is exactly what you're saying. It's an attempt to be pastoral. If we have these Christians who want and are in the military and want to come into church, if you're the local priest, local pastor, you don't know what to do, well, here's a handbook that gives you kind of step by step. First, they do this, then they do that. Or in this situation, you do this. In that situation, you do that. So they really are attempts to be pastoral and to solve some of these pressing questions that people really were wrestling with.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to let you know that a book that I've co-authored is available for purchase, Baptizing America, How Mainline Protestants Help Build Christian Nationalism. You can order it wherever you buy your books or head to the show notes at dogma.wardenway.org to find a discount code for ordering it directly from Chalice Press. Order Baptizing America today.
So then Constantine comes and the empire flips. And how do Christians now respond? You know, because you trace some of the ways that Christian responses now to the Roman military changes as well.
Yeah. So it is certainly, again, not universal. You know, there's always complexity. But in general, what you see is increasingly people are more and more accepting of the idea of Christian military service. So there's a guy named Lactantius who is a very interesting figure because he spans the gap between before Constantine and then after Constantine. And he demonstrates, you know, kind of a real shift. You see it in his life. His life is sort of an example of the whole thing that's happening in the church as a whole. But you know, right before Constantine, it was the most difficult for the church it had ever been. There was some persecution, empire-wide, top-down persecution, some of that in the Roman period, not as much as you might think from watching Hollywood movies, but there was some of that. But the period right before Constantine was the most significant period of persecution that the church had. Just very difficult time, church buildings being destroyed, copies of scripture confiscated and burned, and people losing their lives. So, you know, very, very significant persecution. So Lactantius, you know, lived through that. He saw that, and he very much thought at the time, you know, the emperor is, you know, these emperors are evil. It's God's justice on these, it's God's justice on these people that they have been removed from power by Constantine. Look, the army is now God's instrument to wipe these people out. Whereas before, Lactantius has some passages that are very much pacifist in nature. Lactantius, before Constantine came to power, he says, God forbids us to kill. He prohibits us from open violence, which, you know, nobody can kill people just in the street. Everybody agrees that's right. But Lactantius says, it's neither lawful nor just for a man to engage in warfare. So he's, I don't know if you'd call him a pacifist, but you know, pretty much, you know, violence is wrong for Christians. But then this persecution is ended by Constantine. Constantine comes to power. And suddenly, oh, look, this is God's man. The army is God's instrument to pull out justice on our enemies, vengeance on our enemies. So I think it's possible to read people like that in two ways. You can take a more cynical approach to them of, look, this guy just wants to see his enemies beat up, and he changed his tune because now he's in power and he's the one holding the sword rather than the one being struck by the sword. So now violence is okay. You can take it more cynically, but I think you can also see it, you really can see it a little bit more charitably as an evolution in the Christian story and a response to new situations, where before the church was on the margins of society, or at least, you know, not pulling the levers of power. So it was easy to say, you know, warfare is always wrong. But if we have this Christian emperor, which, you know, for my opinion was probably a misstep, but if it's happened, and if we have this guy, now we have this Christian who's responsible for 60 million people, the good of all these people, does a Christian emperor not need a Christian army to protect all these people? So you can see it very cynically, but you can also see it as sort of restating the faith for new context for a situation that Jesus and Paul and some of these first people we're never in, where we have a Christian seated on the throne, pulling all the levers of power.
Yeah, I mean, your tone in your answer there is also the tone that's in your book that, you know, is good, is that you're trying to help us see and understand and imagine, like, what's happening here and why might they be writing and saying what they want, whereas I tend to just go straight to the cynical response here. And, you know, so, you know, you're helping us think about this more pastorally than I would. But, yeah, I mean, because it does seem like we have this temptation of power and violence, like, wins over many of them, and they seem to flip-flop. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as we think about even the current day, which you do at the end of the book, and your subtitle is Lessons for Today, right? I mean, that is one of the temptations and one of the issues that we have, because, as you noted, we're in the world's superpower. We're in the, you know, the empire of the world. And so, you know, particularly for Christians in the United States, I mean, I think your book, the idea of looking at the Roman army and how Christians are responding, could be helpful for Christians anywhere, but particularly for Christians in the United States, we're the, you know, there's significant differences, but we're the closest to living in the Roman Empire that, you know, exists today. And so, you know, this glorification of power and violence in our country, this idea, this, you know, theology of might makes right. And so, you know, we've got the big army, so therefore God must be on our side. I mean, all of that is tempting still today. That hasn't gone away. So how do we think about that?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, so I certainly think that is something that we can learn from the first Christians. It's something the book touches on a little bit. You know, there, at different points in the church, there has been, in my opinion, maybe an overemphasis on martyrdom and an over-glorification of martyrdom. And, you know, we should hope that, to me, it seems like there were times in the church where the goal was to get yourself killed, whereas I think we should hope that the goal is for human flourishing, and God wants, you know, us to live lives that glorify him, not just die in a way that glorifies him. So maybe a little bit too much emphasis on martyrdom, but I think what we can learn, you know, from this long history of martyrdom is that there were people in the early church who felt so strongly that there was no Lord other than God, other than Jesus. There was no other Lord, that they were willing to die for that. And they felt strongly enough about that. And, you know, again, I don't want to go back to the martyrdom days, but that conviction and how strongly they believed in that really says something to Christians who put God and country in the same breath, because that's something that they felt strongly enough to die for, that their allegiance, they wanted good government, they wanted, you know, to live in a safe society, they wanted to do their part, but their allegiance was to God. Their allegiance was not to the Roman Empire. So the nationalist streak that some of us get, the Christian nationalism that is such a hot topic today, I think when you go back and look at this history, certainly before Constantine, for sure, you know, the earliest, most primitive expression of our faith, closest in time to Jesus and Paul, that would have just been completely unthinkable, which I think is a very helpful perspective check for some of us today.
So let's talk a little bit then about, you know, today's situation, the United States military, and, you know, Christians are thinking about, you know, can I serve? Should I serve? Churches, you know, responding to how do we reach out to individuals who are in the military? You know, this is the question that we were just talking about a moment ago. Like, they're wrestling with, can you join the church? And what do you need to do to join the church if you're in the military? Like, we don't really have those kind of conversations today. So help us think about some ways. I mean, you have a bunch of steps at the end of your book. So maybe we can think about a couple of different ways in this conversation that Christians and churches can wrestle with these issues. And again, you're not giving us a, you know, black and white, universal, like, this is the answer. You're wanting us to have these conversations.
Yeah, yeah. And I would hope that the local churches all across the world, you know, can come to different responses on some of these questions. That, to me, is one of the beauty of the church, particularly in a polarized society where we live in, that it's one of the few places, and we can't always do it in church, but hopefully in church, it's one of the few places where we can have nuanced conversations.
You have conflict in your Baptist church? You don't all agree?
never. But, you know, the goal would be that the church is one of the few places where we can be with people who are different and have nuanced conversations. And so churches, I think, are going to land on different places on some of these questions. Particular questions, churches will land in different places on these questions. But, you know, thinking about what are some things that we can do to address these questions today. And one thing that I would really, that to me strikes me very strongly when reading this early history, is how much more successful the pastoral approaches are than the dogmatic approaches. So there are tons of early church figures who are saying, you can't be a Christian and join the army. You can't be a Christian and join the army. Violence is wrong. You can't join the army. But what happens? There's more and more Christians in the army. So to me, there's something important in that, that we can have convictions and we can speak truthfully to our convictions, and we should never, you know, mask what we understand to be God's truth because it's convenient or, you know, helpful for us. But at the same time, there's a recognition, I think, that the people who tried to meet soldiers where they were, somebody like Augustine, for example, he had a relationship with this military commander that, you know, Augustine was somebody who was a little more comfortable with the use of force than some of the other people were, but he still saw it as a very, you know, complex subject. He was not always happy with what this military commander did, but he kept up a pastoral relationship with this man named Boniface. And it really seems like it made a difference in his life that he kept the relationship, kept the dialogue going, and that made an impact on him. So, you know, that to me is something I think churches of all kinds of stripes could learn when thinking about service members, reaching out to members of the military, is that pastoral character, where if you're a conservative evangelical church that already has a military ministry, or, you know, has no objection to starting a military ministry if you don't, if you go out there with a, you know, glorification of the troops, the troops are heroes, the troops are, you know, God's people, that is not always, it's, you know, you might think that's supporting the troops, but it's not always helpful, because in reality, people have very different perspectives on their service. Some people go into the service, have a great time, love it, see no issues between their service and their faith. Other people are find themselves in the service for different reasons, but really wonder. Yeah, I remember talking to a guy who was in the Navy. He was a weapons officer, so he was actually going to push the button on the destroyer to launch the weapons. And he wondered, you know, I did this in training, but if it actually came up in real life, could I actually do this? Is this compatible with my faith in Jesus? There, you know, there's a lot of complexity. So if you go out there with a glorification of you're a hero, everything you did was great, and don't give them the opportunity to talk back and tell you what's your service really like, how pastoral have you really been? And on the flip side, if you're a, you know, moderate to progressive church, you read the teachings of Jesus and read about turning the other cheek, and you see the kingdom of God as a peaceful kingdom that is different from all the kingdoms of the world, that to me feels very true. I land a little bit more on that side. But at the same time, if we have, you know, millions of people in the armed forces and we want them to engage with the same God that we know, to be able to approach this thoughtful, compassionate, loving Jesus that we know, it doesn't mean that we have to, you know, glorify war, speak in favor of war. I think we should always be opposed to violence and to should see that as a terrible thing. But how can we meet these people where they are and understand, why'd you choose this career? How can we walk alongside you while you're in this career serving your country? Where can we find common ground and minister to you where you are? That to me just seems so much more fruitful than to be dogmatic on either end.
Yeah. And, you know, especially, I mean, and you unpack some of this in the book, but I mean, we know that there's a lot of impacts of serving in the military, and particularly in combat today. I mean, impact on families, obviously, but impact on the individuals. You know, we hear the news all the time about the rate of suicide among veterans, which is incredibly high. I mean, so there's a lot of ministry need right there that doesn't fit into either the two extremes. And we often hear from the people that do the glorification that, you know, we support our troops, this, you know, but yet while doing all of the glorification and praise of the military and quote, supporting our troops, the support, the troops aren't actually feeling, and the veterans aren't actually feeling supported. And this is exactly the type of space that churches should be filling in a society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that I think was true in the early church's experience and still has the potential to be so true in our contemporary experience, is that what's striking when you read the story is that certainly the people at the top, most of them are speaking against Christian military service, but then we still have all of these troops, whether they go into the military as Christians or whether they're converted already in the military, but we have all these Christian troops who still want to be part of the church, and they are willing to, you know, from my perspective, almost enter into a hostile environment because they see something in the church and in the worship life of the church, the service of the church, that seems so valuable to them and something that is worth going through. Some of them are going to jump through these hoops that the church puts periods of repentance or, you know, different steps they have to go through. They're willing to do this because they want to be part of the church and they see something valuable in the church. And I would really like to believe that that is, you know, true for us today, that if we take the, you know, the most significant case of a combat veteran from the armed forces today, I think that person, if they can find the right church, there is so much that can be offered there. You know, an opportunity to be yourself, to tell your story in a non-judgmental way, have people listen to you without judgment and with love. How many places in society are you going to find that? The opportunity to participate in worship and liturgy for people who've experienced PTSD, some of these repetitive patterns are very helpful and very soothing. And that's what the worship life of many churches offers, is this kind of predictable way of being with other people and connecting with God. So just so much that the church can offer to members of the military today.
So as we wrap up here, I want to ask you a question that you don't directly address in your book, but 4th of July is coming up. And I know you're like, oh no. And you're a pastor, you have to deal with this every year, but you know, and there are other, you know, the patriotic Sundays, right? You know, Memorial Day, Veterans Day, right? And some of the, I mean, you know, some of the issues are just, you know, Christian nationalism and, you know, nationalistic, you know, flavor. But I want to particularly ask about thinking about the military, because that's what you have been thinking about and writing about. Mm-hmm, like, what would be your advice to churches in thinking about services around these patriotic Sundays? Do we do anything? Do we, you know... I mean, you know, there are some churches like a First Baptist Church in Dallas that, you know, they shoot off the fireworks in the sanctuary, which seems like an insurance risk. But then they also like they will play the anthems of every single branch of the U.S. military and have uniformed members of each branch, you know, carrying the flags of those branches in their worship service. So, I mean, there's that model.
Right.
I assume that's not happening at your church. So, you know, what's your advice on how to deal with these types of Sundays?
Yeah. So I think if I could leave one piece of advice and maybe some secondary advice, I could give that too. But my one main piece of advice, I think, would just be to know your context. If you're a pastor, a church leader, know your context and think about what is a gospel response in your context. So if you are in an area that has a lot of veterans, you know, you may have some people for whom that is, for whom their service to their country is important all the time, but it's particularly important around some days like Veterans Day or 4th of July. So, you know, to me, there is no harm in bringing, no harm and a good bit of good in bringing all the aspects of ourselves to God. And so if you are a fireman, you know, God, you can be a fireman, help people, be a Christian. You know, so there are ways that which we can catch up our what we call our secular lives, for lack of a better word, and bring those to God. And so there are ways of praying and appreciation for the blessings that we do have in this country and freedoms that we do enjoy, and being thankful for these good things that we have, without it turning into a glorification of anything. Maybe sort of related to that, a question I think about a lot is when thinking about worship is who is the object of worship here? So we just sort of came through graduation season as we're recording this, and graduate recognition is a thing that I really struggle with as a pastor. A lot of churches do graduate recognition, and those services to me feel like they become about graduates oftentimes more than about God. And that to me just feels, you know, deeply misguided. If there are ways that we can celebrate good things that are happening and bring those to God, that's one thing. But if the focus is on people, haven't we kind of missed the point? And I think you can certainly, with some of the patriotic services that you're describing, you can get to a point where you have to ask yourself, who are we really worshiping here? Are we bringing part of ourselves to this holy God, or are we really putting the focus on ourselves? And so I think if you get to that point, you've missed the mark.
So you're not going to shoot off fireworks during your service?
I will not shoot off fireworks. The other thing I would kind of say too, if I could put in one more piece of advice as I think about it, you know, are there steps that you can take that move the ball forward as you understand it as a leader, as a pastor, but that are still, you know, relevant to your congregation, compatible with your congregation? So in my particular context, we do have an American flag in the sanctuary. We do have some veterans who that's important to them. That tradition is important to them. If I were starting a church, if I were planning a church right now, would I put a flag in the sanctuary? You know, no, I wouldn't. But for my context, that's important. But what I did do is we had an American flag and a Christian flag, and we took the Christian flag out of the sanctuary because nobody really cares about the Christian flag here. And to me, the Christian flag is almost worse than the American flag because it conveys to me the idea that what we're doing here in the church is like the same thing that you're doing when you go to school and say the Pledge of Allegiance. And, you know, to me, I appreciate the country and good governance, all those things is so important. But to me, what we're doing here in the church is so much deeper and so much more significant, so much more powerful than what any country on the earth is doing. And so why do we want to equate this Jesus movement with an American flag? So let's take that Christian flag out. And that to me was something that's important. It was compatible with people here. And I think it kind of moves us in the right direction. So do what you can do. Take the steps that you can take and move the ball forward.
Well, the book is Christians and the Roman Army, Lessons for Today. I encourage people to pick it up. And I should note that, I mean, it also has lots of pictures in it. So, you know,
yes,
for people who like picture books, this is the way to go. And so, you know, historical, archaeological, and other types of images. And so, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on the program and for helping us think about some complex but important issues.
Yeah, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.